Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots.
For dinner and to record our next episode of our Great Scots series, and I am coming in and I'm just about to start preparing the recipe that I've chosen from the cookbook for tonight. So as we'll go into in the episode, this cookbook has a chapter on Scotch national dishes, and I was flicking through and it's an early cookbook published in the 1820s, so some of these recipes are far beyond the capability I have between Peter coming in and me getting in from the office. You know, you have roasting a whole pig or drappet eggs, stovetow tidy with drappet eggs, excellent titles. You've got potted head, minced collops, friar's chicken sounded really good as well. But what I've gone for was, one, a choice of convenience, because it looked like a fairly simple recipe. And when I was asking Peter what he wanted as a choice between a Scotch broth or this, he said that there was really only one option. So I'm about to start preparing a fitless cock. And it's described in the cookbook as an antique Scotch dish, now seldom seen on any table. It's got suet and oatmeal, pepper, salt and onions. I'm opting for white pepper. Because I think that, to me, it has more of a like Scottish national taste. It just reminds me of like broth and scurly and things that my granny used to cook. So I just need to combine these ingredients. I'm going to do two versions because the recipe says it must be boiled in a cloth, but I've actually never boiled a pudding before, which as a food historian feels like a massive faux pas. But I also don't know how that's going to go. I'm also using a tea towel, so I'm going to do a baked version as well, which I think will come out like some sort of scurly or stuffing. So I'm just going to go and do this preparation, and I'll be ready to greet Peter with this delicious sounding historical dish.
Lindsay, can you introduce our great Scot for this evening?
The great Scot that we are looking at this evening is Christian Isabel Johnson, whose maiden name was Todd.
Yep.
And Christian Isabel Johnson was born in 1781 in Edinburgh, and she died in 1857. So she's sort of slightly pre-Victorian. And the book that we're going to be considering, The Cook and Housewife's Manual, was published in 1826. So it's a pre-Victorian text, but a wonderful cookbook. And I first came across it because I was looking at texts published in the 1820s for a research project I was doing. And I found this cookbook and it was amazing, and it was Scottish and it had so much Scottishness layered into it. But what was really interesting to me was that from doing a bit of digging online, I realised that Christian Isabel Johnson was the author, but she's not mentioned anywhere in the text.
Mm-hmm.
So who she was as an actual person, she was an incredibly industrious woman. And I think one of the things I love about her, first and foremost, is she got a divorce very early on.
Yeah.
This is not common.
In the first line, when you Google mm-hmm. Christian Isabel Johnson, it's she got married at 16.
Yep.
And then divorced.
That is such a power move.
Oh, and I will say, in doing my own family genealogy, mm-hmm. I have never had such a flutter mm-hmm. as to when I came across in 1850 a big divorce stamp on one of my ancestors' marriage certificates.
Gosh. I mean, it's a big deal.
I mean, it's still to be honest, it's still a big deal.
Of course it's still a big deal.
But back then, it was newly legal.
Yeah.
You know?
And she was getting divorced. Well, she got married in, like, the very early 1800s. She then got divorced and she married her second husband in 1815.
Mm.
So this is like so on the cusp of things being acceptable or not. And yeah. It wouldn't have been acceptable, no. Really. But I feel like, I mean, I obviously don't know this woman, but in the way that any historian does, when you get attached to a historical figure, you start like imagining things, yes, about their personality. I feel like this speaks to her being a powerhouse, being a force,
mm,
you know, being someone who's married someone and being like, actually, this is not for me. Let's action this.
And may also, there are lots of influences in the 19th century as to why people use pen names or pseudonyms.
Yes, of course.
But as someone who may have experienced shame in, yep, her community, maybe makes sense,
yep,
or alludes to why she then went under to write under a pseudonym for, exactly, her most popular book.
Exactly. But once she'd had that first scandalous, maybe not divorce, she married her then husband, who was John Johnson, giving her the Christian Isabel Johnson. And they, obviously we don't know what their day-to-day life was like, but they seem to have been more of a powerhouse couple in that they were both journalists, they were both writers, both authors, both publishers. So Christian Isabel Johnson was this incredibly industrious female, like early Victorian, early 19th century female journalist. She was an editor of the Inverness Courier, and they actually began that. It was, mm-hmm, a weekly newspaper, and they were co-editors, which is a really nice little detail. There seems to be an equality running throughout this, which quite often you don't actually get. And when she was doing her co-editing of the Inverness Courier, that was when she started sort of publishing a cookery column. But yeah, she had all these sort of amazing strings to her bow. She wrote novels. She was really active politically. She, Johnson's basically then turned into Tate's Edinburgh Magazine, which is one of the most prolific magazines in the 19th century, published out of Edinburgh. So this is a woman who is a force in terms of publishing, in terms of writing, in terms of putting stuff out there. And that was something that made it very interesting for me that, as you said, her most successful work was a cookbook that was not published under her name.
Yeah.
And that was The Cook and Housewife's Manual. And it was published in 1826. And the author on the page was a Meg Dodds.
Hmm. I do have a little factoid here.
Go for it.
To lay some context to people that were using pen names in this era, mm-hmm, which is that in 1830, roughly 80% of novels were issued under a pen name or were anonymous.
Wow.
And a lot of it is to do with marketing,
mm-hmm,
a lot of it is to do with attitudes in the time towards fame.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that Christian Isabel Johnson was perhaps a religious woman.
Mm-hmm.
There's some notes of her engaging in Catholic poetry, which is a way of like writing poetry with a certain rhythm and timbre, and it all leads towards kind of celebrating Catholic tenets and kind of a religious outlook on life. But it ties with someone who maybe was a woman of faith,
yep,
who then wouldn't want to push herself into the limelight and chose to write under a pseudonym. But there are other reasons.
And I think this is a particularly interesting example of the use of a pseudonym, because this was, Meg Dodds is not a pseudonym that is an unattached name.
Mm.
Meg Dodds was actually a character from a Sir Walter Scott novel.
Right. And who was this character?
So this Sir Walter Scott, I don't know if you know, I don't know if our readers know, was one of the most famous, celebrated kind of romantic, so pre-Victorian, romantic era authors. And he was Scottish, and he wrote and published one of the books that went on to kind of define what we think of Scottishness now. And that was Waverley, or 60 years hence. And Waverley created this kind of very Jacobean romantic idea of Scotland and the Scottish Highlands, people swathed in tartan and basically the kind of tartan shortbread thing that we have now. Sir Walter Scott, was almost, you can almost pin that romanticization, yep, of Scottishness to that novel.
We could do an entire series addressing the ways in which Sir Walter Scott has damaged Scotland.
We need reparations.
Because he created an ideal.
He did.
Sold it to the rich and powerful, sold it to the king.
Yeah.
And said suddenly, being Scottish had an expectation that was not aligned with anything that the everyday people were living through.
And this was a very, like, well-connected man. Like, one of his best friends was William Wordsworth. And they were always hanging out in the Lake District. And then, of course, William and Dorothy would go on their tours of the Highlands and they would write about them. And that kind of, that was the start of Scotland becoming a tourist attraction, basically. Because these people, these authors, these people of culture were going around, they were capturing it, they were making it a kind of attractive place to be and selling it as an experience. So Meg Dodds is a character from one of Walter Scott's novels, which is called St. Ronan's Well. And it's actually an interesting novel. It was one of the only ones that he published that was set during the time he actually wrote it. So rather than being a historical novel, which looked back with those rose-tinted glasses, it was set at the time. But in the novel itself, Meg Dodds is the innkeeper in this small spa town. And she, the inn is kind of where most of the stuff in the novel goes down. People are having meals, you know, and she is cooking the meals.
Right.
So it's this wee Scottish woman where a lot of not Scottish people are coming to this inn to engage in frolics. And that's who Meg Dodds was.
Right. So again, you're kind of, when we're thinking about Victorian marketing and tying yourself to a name, you're choosing a name that will be in the public consciousness as a character surrounded by Scottish food in a pub in the Highlands.
It couldn't have been a more convenient person to pretend to write a cookbook by. It would be like, I can't even think of an equivalent of who, it would be like you or I trying to like publish a cookbook that was specifically tied to Outlander or something like that. Like that idea of the Highlands, you know. And Walter Scott was an author with clout, like serious clout. So this was not a bad choice on the part of Johnson to choose Meg Dodds as her pseudonym. It was a really good marketing choice. When I came across this cookbook for the first time, I wasn't familiar with this novel of Scott's. So Meg Dodds or Margaret Dodds did not initially like spark any kind of association for me. And I just kind of read it as verbatim. And what I was looking into at the time was the difference between cookbook introductions that were written by male authors versus cookbook introductions written by female authors. So I'd found this cookbook written by, as far as I could tell from the name, a woman. But the introduction was like batshit wild.
Right, okay.
It was just so weird. And this was the first time I was like, okay, I need to do a bit more digging. And it didn't take me long to realize, of course, it's a kind of fictional offshoot, what we would call an intertext or a paratext from the initial novel.
Okay.
Meaning it's like a connected text in some way because it uses the same characters. So in the introduction to this cookbook, what we have is a series of characters, not just from Walter Scott's novel, St. Ronan's Well, but other works of Scottish fiction, including Susan Ferrier's novel, Marriage. So there's a Dr. Redgill character who comes from that book. And these men who are fictional characters are coming together in a fictional character's inn, Meg Dodds's inn. And what they do is they start up a supper club. And in their supper club, they're basically talking about how thinking about food and feeling about food and having all these grand thoughts and indulging the body, but in a very, you know, high-minded way, is connecting them to all these centuries past of great thinkers of men.
Of course.
Of course. So there's this very masculine thing where they're all like, you can imagine them sitting around a table with their drams and they're all like, they're highfalutin talk. And they're like, ah, yes, you know, Pythagoras loved beans because they were good for the digestion.
Right.
And like they talk about Dr. Johnson and there's basically this whole thing of them referencing loads of famous men from the past because they're trying to kind of grasp clout. And the hilarious
clout chasers, as we would call them today.
Exactly. And the hilarious thing about this introduction is at first it doesn't read as satire because that was very common for 19th, 18th, 19th century male cookbook writers to actually do. Like William Kitchener, for example, amazing cookbook, worth a look. For but it's called like Apicius. It's like named after the Latin, and he starts it off with this like opening thing where he's sitting by a fire and he compares himself to Ovid.
Of course.
And it's like, I mean, I'm sure there's a sense of humor there, but it's also like, get over yourself.
If it was 2012, he would have a beanie on and a guitar.
Exactly. So there's this whole thing. So I was reading this introduction, genuinely not getting that it was satire until the character of Meg Dodds comes in. And what she does is beautifully breaks through this, all this arsery, basically, all this flummery that these guys are spitting out, these fictional men. And she kind of cuts through it instantly. She, like, has all these interjections into the text while they're planning their supper club and they're talking about all this high-minded stuff. And she says things like, what a style of language, you know? And it's always, like, it's always separated from the text. It's in brackets. I think what Christian has done as an authoress is been really clever about the way she's kept Meg Dodds separate from these
arses.
Exactly, arses. And she's like, what a style of language, whispered Mrs. Dodds, but I'm on look after the scouring of the kettles. So it's like she's actually getting on with the food stuff while these idiots are just talking about it in these high-minded ways.
I feel like you're not really giving your all to the accent of Meg Dodds. I feel like you're just doing Lindsay, but I feel like you should do a line reading again, but really put yourself into the mind of a long 19th century
pub audience. Okay. Cook. What a style of language, whispered Meg Dodds, but I won't look after the scouring of the kettles.
Well, a BAFTA for Dr. Lindsay Middleton. Well done.
But these always happen, and she's breaking in, but she also slacks them off. Like, she's constantly, like, actually poking fun at these men. So what Christian has done is this amazing kind of playing with all these genres. Not, she's using a novel, which is clever enough as it is a great marketing tactic. Fans of Walter Scott are going to read this and be tickled because they're
licensing,
like,
hasn't been invented yet.
Exactly. Copyright. Pff, who whatever. Is she?
Yeah.
We don't know her. They're reading this. They're going to be tickled. But what she's actually done is kind of goes above that. And she's using these fictional men to, and her fictional woman character, to poke fun at the cookbook genre, where men were often just, like, putting themselves up on these pedestals and women were actually the ones that were getting on with the cooking in the kitchens.
Mm.
So it's genius. She's a genius.
Is there an equivalent today? I feel like the modern cookbook is perhaps more focused on interjecting, like, personal story. Memoir mm-hmm. is really strong in cookbook. I think Nigella in her How to Eat was really influential yeah. in that.
Nigel Slater
as well. Is there, what do you think the next, if we've had novel and memoir, are we going to go back to novel? Are we going to have a meshing of the two? We have like biographical fiction playing out against recipes.
It's a really interesting one. And I think there's also kind of mystery third category where it's like,
VR.
No. No. Smell-o-vision. No. Yes. No to smell-o-vision. No, there's also cookbooks that are inspired by fiction, right? So you can buy, like, yes. the Downton Abbey cookbook, you can buy yeah. Bridgerton cookbook, written, may I just say, by very good food historians. So, yeah. you know, you can believe what is in the
class. We're in a group chat with, like, half of them.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Shout out Annie and Regula. But anyway. But no, so there's that. But I think it's an interesting one. Not many people write or live food fictionally anymore. There's obviously great novels and things. One of my favourite novels is that I actually wrote about when I was a teeny tiny undergraduate. It's called The Debt to Pleasure by John Lanchester.
Okay.
And it was written in the 70s, and it's about this, like, guy. And it's structured as a series of menus and recipes. And as you read, it gets more sinister and you realise there's stuff going on, but it's good. But I think there's, because food is such a creative endeavour, there's such ripe potential for that to be played with across, like, the fiction, non-fiction genre. I mean, do you have favourite, like, representations of food in literature or film or, like, you know, non-real life, as it were?
When I think about Scottish food in media,
mm-hmm.
The only thing that I could think of was the porridge oat adverts.
Scottish oats.
Maybe say Scotch beef as well.
An Iron Brew made from Girders.
I will say Scots oats
and
Scotch beef have two things in common. And that is a man wearing a tiny white t-shirt.
Yeah. And not just any man, like quite a specific physique of man.
And the Scotch oats, I mean, when you think back to what I was watching on television, it's because it was a queue of ladies going out the shop looking for Scots oats. And they go into the shop and there's Scots oats everywhere. And they only ask for the one on the top shelf.
Yeah.
And then he starts to climb the ladder and you realise that he's wearing a kilt and all the ladies in the shop look up the kilt and he's...
And it's basically upskirting.
It's upskirting.
Because he's going full Highland. We would... Full Scotsman, full as we would say. I thought we had another... Don't know what full Highland is. Don't know what full Highland is.
Anyway, moving on. But yeah, I see that is what, and Scotch beef was similarly so, but it was about the comparison of like, do you want a man of quality or a man eating a pot noodle? The Scotch beef man. When I look back on it now, they weren't that attractive.
Well, it's not even about that. It's just about how uncomfortable it was. Like,
I don't know if I was uncomfortable.
You were just disappointed.
I was just...
Come on, we can do better.
We can do better. Well, no. At the time, it was like 90s hot and 2025 hot is two very different things.
Yeah, that's fair.
Scientists have perfected man at this point. And like...
A 90s 10 is like a
2005 like a, 4.
Yeah.
But... that's what I think. But again, that's related to like provenance and like product and things. I myself cannot think of Scottish food in media.
No, it's an interesting one, and I struggle to as well. And I think that's why I love this cookbook particularly, because it's such an early good example of the blending of like really good Scottish fiction or really famous Scottish fiction with food. And the thing about the way that Christian does it is it's not a piss take. Like, her introduction is a piss take. Don't get me wrong. It's a piss take of publishing culture that champions men. It's a piss take of cookbook culture where all these men are writing all these ridiculous introductions. But it's also a piss take of, like, Scottish food as something to be fetishized. Like, even at this point, in 1826, like, she's pointing at the fact that, like, we have all these ideas of Scottish food. And, like, Meg Dodds as a character kind of undercuts them with her practicalities. And then what's really interesting is when the introduction ends, so we've had this, it's like pages and pages long of all these characters from not just Scott, but other other novels having these debates about food. It's all very funny. It's, you know, it's japes. It's like, oh, we're having these literary laughs. And then the cookbook is just a cookbook. And you can tell that the cookbook, like the recipes, they're all wonderful. They work. They're not, like, taking the piss, and they were in Christian's writing. So she's taken, she's played with this whole literary culture, and then she's been like, right, well, here's a cookbook. And sometimes you get a footnote where Meg Dodds will, like, weigh in on whatever the recipe is. But other than that, there's no presence of the characters in the actual working text.
Right.
So you have a very practical, early example of a really good Scottish cookbook. So it's so interesting that it's like these two things.
I wonder if the next thing that might happen is where we see things like that, where cookbooks are opened with story, and now we see cookbooks inspired by story.
Yeah.
Is the next step that we see recipes ingrained in story?
Yeah.
So scripts or films or television shows surround food. As a way for people to experience it themselves. The sensory pleasures of eating food while you watch the food.
Yeah.
In,
is this you coming back to smell-o-vision, Peter?
I don't... we could settle for a scratch and sniff, which, by the way, is the worst name for any invention.
Like, it really, really
it's
is.
It's really horrid. But I always feel like... I've been seeing this on TikTok at the moment, where parents or really cool friends are having... eat along with Okay. The movie.
Yes, I've seen this too.
And so like Lady and the Tramp.
Or Lord of the Rings or something.
Yes.
You're like, oh, they're
and
eating.
They serve the food along with the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this is all about our hunger for experience.
Yes.
And food is such a fantastic gateway into experience
mm-hmm.
because it's sensory, it's tactile.
It's multi-sensory as well. Like it's touch, taste, smell, everything. Sight, everything.
Yeah. And it also fills you. Mm-hmm. It fulfills a human function.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of other art
that
keeps you alive.
That we need to survive.
That you need to survive. Yeah. And eating artfully, I think, I believe, might be the next step.
Mm.
Now, that is separated from people that are surviving.
Of
course. Or me in January. And this might be entirely based on the fact that I've been eating beans on toast for 3 weeks. But I think that could be a really interesting sphere where I think probably Netflix will chuck some money at something and there'll be a recipe thing and probably a poorly written show and they'll say it doesn't work.
Well, you've already seen, like, I don't know if you've seen this on TikTok.
TikTok.
Well, you've got...
Sorry, go on.
Well, you've already seen, or I don't know if you have, but I've seen on TikTok, like very, very contemporary shows like Squid Game now have eating experiences where you can go and eat the food from, and like you actually go to a place and eat the food that's in the show. And it's just like, okay, this is, you're right. It's a way for people to tap into experiences that don't exist in the real world because that's what they actually want to experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which if you're reading the Cooking Housewives manual, you're maybe like, oh, I could be in Meg Dodds's Inn.
Like, yeah, I could
cooking
be in the pub.
These recipes. Exactly. With Dr. Redgill, you know, and having all these conversations with Walter Scott's characters. And I do feel like it's tied into this uncomfortable Scottish marketing. But the fact that Christian, as a Scottish authoress, is making fun of that is great to me.
Well, I think we should take a quick break and then let's come in and chat about the food.
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So, from a recipe point of view, what is a fitless cock?
So, a fitless cock is actually quite simple. And in the chapter in Meg Dodds's cookbook, or Isabel Johnson's cookbook, it's also called an oatmeal dumpling.
Mm.
And basically, the ingredients are oatmeal, onions, salt, pepper, and suet. And that's it.
No spices?
Salt and pepper. So, in the recipe, it calls for oatmeal, suet, to be flavoured with onions, salt and pepper as a white pudding. And it says it must be boiled in a cloth. So I've prepared for us two fitless cocks, one of which I baked in the oven/air fryer because, like, boiling puddings kind of scares me.
Yep.
And the other of which I actually boiled. And actually, the one that I boiled kind of looks better. But we can give them both a go.
Yeah. What are we looking at? So I'm looking at a small white enamel dish, a blue rim dish that I'm not going to touch with my hands because I'm not an idiot, Peter. And it looks a bit like, it looks like a porridge, like a kind of like an oaty flapjack.
Like a baked porridge or baked flapjack. Yeah. And the other bowl is slightly less visually appealing.
Yes.
But holds the actual authentic fitless cock. Although what I didn't manage to do from the recipe is at the end it says it should be forced into the shape of a chicken.
So the term fitless cock is that it's a chicken.
Yeah, a cockerel.
A cockerel without life.
Yes.
It's something to replace on a... How can you touch that with your fingers?
Asbestos hands.
Is that... Okay.
Just lots of picking up pans. Without oven gloves. It's not too bad anymore, to be fair.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Okay, yeah.
So, the thing that I also failed to mention is the other ingredient that's in this that isn't in most sort of puddings I've seen or dumplings that I've seen is egg.
Okay.
So it's bound with egg.
And I was leaning back into the chicken of it all.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder whether that maybe is where the name comes from. My cat Soup is very interested in the fitless cock.
This is animal. Is can cats eat onions?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I think they are toxic, but he was born in a bin and he eats right, lots okay. of things that are toxic and they're fine. Yep, do you see? Okay. Shall you? Which one are you going for? They're very different in form.
They are.
The one that's boiled.
Do you have a? Can you get your phone? Like
sausage. Yeah, I'm going to go take a picture. And we'll take
pictures to upload.
Alongside.
So you can head to Tenement Kitchen and Dr. Lindsay Middleton on Instagram to see pictures of a fitness cog.
Okay.
Okay, right. I'm tucking into the boiled.
Which actually looks more appealing, I have to say.
I'm not going to agree with you. Okay, here we go.
A decent amount of beef suet in there too. Mm-hmm. Oh. Mm. Nope.
There's a cat climbing on me right now. Okay. Initial thoughts.
Could have done with more salt.
Could have done with another tablespoon of salt.
Yeah.
That might be personal.
Again, though, you're not going on rest. No, I think it needs more salt, but it just says salt. And I did a decent amount.
But the texture-wise, it feels meaty.
Yeah, it's like a sausage.
I think when we're thinking about what it's trying to replace, is for people that either are abstaining.
Yeah.
If we are assuming that the kind of references to her writing about Catholic cookery, or sorry, Catholic poetry.
Yeah.
We also know that Catholic food writers included lots of meat-free recipes.
Yeah.
If this is to replace a meat, I can see why. Because it is substantial. Mm. Even a small bite of it packs a punch.
Yeah, it's got like a sausagey texture rather than like a puddingy texture.
It's much better with salt.
Okay, maybe that was just me not putting enough salt in.
There's you can bite from all right, yeah.
Bite from your Phyllis cock. Come on now, Peter.
You get more of the onion when you get a bit more of the salt.
Mm.
It also wouldn't be amiss with like some like.
Some more spices. Thyme? Yeah. So the recipe was very... I would have normally put in like maybe some nutmeg, maybe some spices.
Yeah.
But the recipe just said onion, salt and pepper. So there's a lot of white pepper in it, which I think gives it a bit of a more of a interesting taste.
It arrives. But we just did a show for BBC Radio Scotland looking at historic recipes, one of which was a historic haggis recipe. It's not a million miles away.
No, it's really not.
The kind of the oatmeal, I would say the haggis recipe was...
more spiced.
It was richer.
Yeah.
It had the same amount of suet, but had like cream and milk and the oats were like soaked and things like that. So why did you choose that recipe, other than the hilarious name?
I mean, the name did have... a fair amount.
Is it just the name?
No. Basically, I was looking through. So what's interesting about this cookbook, despite the fact it's by a Scottish author pretending to be a Scottish character, is the fact that even within the cookbook, she has a distinct chapter for Scotch national dishes.
Yeah.
Rather than the whole cookbook just being like, this is Scottish, like she separates that out in the beginning of the cookbook. From the rest of the recipes, which are kind of just your more distinct, normal 19th century recipes. So like soups, roasts, she has directions for carving, directions for boiling. Very typical of what you would get of the genre at the time. So in the chapter where she has Scotch national dishes, you have things like cockaliki soup, which is great. Hotchpotch, winter hotchpotch, which was my other potential. But there's also things like fat rose, which involves boiling an entire ox head. So I wasn't going to do that. But I find it interesting that she's still separated it. And I think to me, because she's using Walter Scott's characters, even in 1826, it speaks to the fact that Scottish food was seen as a kind of historical, strange thing to do. Mm. And in this recipe, it's an antique Scotch dish. Apparently, a fitless cock, which doesn't grace our tables anymore.
No.
So there's this interesting historicizing of Scottish food. It's like Scottish food is in the past. So you can make these Scottish dishes as a novelty if you want. But if you're actually cooking, you'll use the rest of the cookbook.
Because we don't see, I don't believe we see that in the same way in English cookery.
No, we don't.
Because we see that that happens again in the 20th century, where we have like the Scottish Women's Royal Institute books until the 1960s are just chapters of dinners, puddings, cakes, preserves. And then when they have the reprint in the 1960s, they take a handful of the recipes, things like haggis, cockleagie soup, and they shove them into a chapter called Scottish Favourites or something.
Yeah.
And we, as again, it's a way where we see the public attitudes to Scottish food change from being, this is food that we eat and we celebrate, that's just, or not even celebrate, it's pedestrian.
Yeah, it's just day-to-day food. And it's like a literal footnoting or like a condensing of a whole nation's cuisine into one tiny chapter.
Why do you think that happens?
I think as a nation, we have this inbuilt kind of self-depreciation about our food. Like British food in general, like the United Kingdom's food, has a bad rep all over the world today, and it has historically. But within that, Scottish food is like the worst. It's like, you know, today the stereotype would be a deep fried Mars bar or just like loads of fried food. But you can, like, this cookbook was published in 1826, and there's already a joke around Scottish food being a bit crap and a bit like flavorless and not very healthy.
Yeah.
So there's this like inbuilt perception of us not having a great cuisine that diminishes it and footnotes it and sidelines it. And it's just like, okay, well then how on earth are we meant to champion things? Because it's become a kind of national self-depreciation. And as a nation, we love laughing at ourselves, and I don't think that's a bad thing. But when it comes to food, it has been damaging.
I think my hypothesis is that I think Scottish people, as a culture, massive generalisation, we expect accountability.
Yeah.
That is tied to our history of clearances, our proximity to poverty, when you're reliant on the people around you to keep you alive, and then you're transplanted to a city, the way that you hold people accountable is through comedy.
Yeah.
Can you take the piss out yourself? Are you too big for your breeks? That sort of thing. And I think, thinking about as well, at the time in 1820, the Highland clearances have been going on for nearly a century.
Yeah.
And what lots of those recipes in that Scottish chapter will have been part of Highland and rural life.
Yeah.
And when you erode a culture, when you take people away from a place, take them away from their food systems, you transplant them into a place which is very unnatural for them. Mm-hmm. They then become reliant on butchers, on recipes, on tinned food. They become reliant on anglicised business working hours and a shape of the year that they don't recognise. They can't engage in what is their everyday pedestrian food in the same way, and they have to become to rely on the other chapters.
Exactly.
So when I was thinking about people that we could invite along to today's episode, I was thinking about who works under a pseudonym.
Yes, under a pseudonym and...
a female food writer.
Yep.
Playing with ideas of Scottishness and national identity and trying to do something new and interesting. There really is only one woman that we could have invited to talk with us today.
Yeah.
There, if you are at all into Scottish food, she will not need an introduction.
No. She's one of these people that comes up, even before I think I followed her on Instagram, she's comes up time and time again, and very clear Scottish message. It's the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. You're immediately broached with a salt hire. Salt hire apron.
Yeah.
And
she's a really good apron.
A really fantastic apron. I'm also deeply resentful of her because of the amount of content she pushes out. I mean,
it's quite impressive.
She is a machine.
Industrious, not unlike Christian Isabel Jones.
Exactly. Well, without further ado, I think it's time for us to give a bell to Roving Haggis, a.k.a. Ali Stoner. So, Ali, I believe you grew up in Helensburgh, born in Helensburgh.
I was born in Glasgow, and then my parents met in Lindsay, and so we first lived in Kirkintilloch for like my early years, And then we moved to Helensburgh.
Were your family Helensburgh or Glasgow?
Well, my dad was Kirkie, born and bred, and as was his, as were both his parents. My mum was born in the islands. Her family are from the Outer Hebrides. And well, her mother's from the Outer Hebrides, her father's from Greenock. She was born in Tobermory and then lived there because my grandfather worked for the post office, or the post office, as they say.
Post office. Love
so
that.
So she was a bit all over, but he ended up being a post office master in Lindsay, and that's then where she met my dad, and you know, the rest was history.
And was, when you were growing up, would you say, was food a sort of part of your family life? Or
yeah,
you know?
Mum's a great cook. So, she was a fabulous cook. She still is, but, you know, she says, oh, I'm rubbish these days. But, you know, she's quite old. But, she was fantastic. And, you know, she had to work to a budget. Everything was made from scratch. And I think she was quite adventurous, really, when I look back at what we were having. You know, she was making pizzas before, you know.
Wow.
The only pizza we'd have was the, you know, deep fried one out the fish and chip shop.
Yeah.
I mean, hers were kind of doughy. They weren't like the pizzas that, you know, everyone's making now. And she was making carbonara. She was a very good and creative cook.
Gosh.
You know, she made spaghetti carbonara instead of using the guanciale, which obviously not accessible in the west of Scotland in the 70s.
No.
She was using pork belly. So she was like switched on to it. She was a good cook. She understood food. And I think we didn't really appreciate how lucky we were, but I think we were informed very early with a very good palate, you know. She says I've not to tell anyone that we used to eat a lot of offal, but we did because, you know, like anybody, she was working to a budget. And I get accused a lot on social media of being posh because of my accent, but, you know, we weren't really that posh. Everyone has a budget. Just because we didn't live in a council house, you know, it doesn't mean that we weren't operating to a budget and shouldn't have to be economical. Kitty, you know.
Can I say I also sometimes suffer from the the posh accent claim? I'm from Paisley, born and bred, as common as they come, but went to uni with a bunch of Irish and English people, and for the first 2 weeks we couldn't understand each other, and we all had to kind of bring it in to some sort of BBC English that we could all kind of try to understand.
I did my foundation art course at Cardonald College in Glasgow, and you know, my accent really then was a lot broader. But then I left Glasgow when I was 18 to moved down to London to finish my education, and you know, so I've spent then the rest. I never moved back to Scotland. I always thought I would, but I never did.
Yeah.
So I think I'm quite lucky that I've retained any Scottish accent, quite frankly.
I think you're doing very well. I can hear it as clear as day.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is a bit posh and no one can place it. That's the thing.
Like,
are you from Bear's Den?
Yeah, it's just non-geographical specific accent.
Yeah, I have the same. So I was born in Aberdeen, but then when I was three, we moved to Canada for a few years. So that kind of, there's a bit of a transatlantic twang on some things. And quite a lot of people are like, oh, are you North American? I'm like, no. And then my mum's Glaswegian, but like posh Glaswegian. She's from Mulgay. And my dad's English. So there's a whole mix there. And people are sort of like, we can tell you're Scottish, but you kind of just sound polite. I'm like, well, okay, thank you.
What a backhanded compliment for the race.
I don't think either of my parents sound particularly, you know, they aren't terribly broad accented. None of our family really are. I've got my aunt lives in Stirling, and maybe they're a bit more, have a stronger accent perhaps, but I don't think any of them are really, I don't think any of our family were really that broad Glaswegian that people expect when you say that you're from Glasgow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. So you were going to study art. Was there a ambition of getting into the arts? Was that the foundation course?
My dad worked in the advertising in Glasgow, and it's ultimately the reason why I went down south, because he knew everybody, and it was quite a small city, and I didn't want to be, I worked in a couple of agencies in Glasgow, and I didn't want to be known as his daughter. I wanted to make my own way, so that's why I went to London. Dick Whittington style, to make my fortune,
right.
You know, and then I just kind of got caught up in working there. And so, yeah, I was a designer, and then I ran my own business in London for like 10 years. And
what were you designing?
I am.
If we can ask.
We were retail specialists. There's a very famous, I've a very famous claim to fame. Well, kind of.
Okay.
That I don't want to oversell myself here. But you know, the Tesco Every Little Helps.
Yes.
Yes.
My handwriting.
No way.
Next
That's
time,
so
stop
cool.
that
Next
right
time,
now.
That's so cool. I'm never going to look at a bag for life the same ever again.
No. I know her. I know.
Yeah,
we've that is wonderful. I wrote that when I was 32. So that was like, you know, quite a long time ago. Maybe I was 33. I was early 30s anyway when I did that. We did a big project for Tesco. They were one of my biggest clients at the time.
So
we did a lot of work for them, and they made a big Every Little Helps project, and that involved taking that, you know, it's probably one of the most famous strap lines in history.
Yeah,
definitely.
Ever. I think it's like, you know, it's well known as being one of the best strap lines ever. We didn't come up with it, I just rewrote it. It was quite funny because I got about 75 people to write it, and I got a handwriting analyst to look at them all, because, you know, we wanted it to look natural, because, you know, whole thing about if you use a typeface, it looks like people just ignore it. It looks like a logo, and he wants to break that visual, like handwriting. So that's why it wasn't perfect. I've noticed somebody's gone in and tried to make it more legible, but the point was it was meant to look like they kind of break the silence of that with handwriting, more like graffiti. And then it was 75 signatures. I called this woman. She used to do like analyze prisoners' handwriting and stuff like that. And I spoke to her and she said, yep, there's only one. And I faxed them through. That's how long ago it was. I faxed through to her. And there's only one, and it's number 14. I went, oh, that's interesting. She goes, it's yours, isn't it? Seriously?
Yeah.
And it was. And she goes, don't change it. So we literally just scanned that in straight off the first one that I'd written.
That is
and
so
became
cool.
Became the kind of, you know, a bit of a cornerstone of what was at the time, a bit of an Every Little Helps campaign. When Tesco
that is not...
themselves.
It's not the influence on food culture I expected to be talking about, but that is quite massive.
Yeah. I feel like there's like a 90s Mad Men series that could be the roving haggis in London, starting the advertising game, rising up through the ranks.
I've got stories.
I'm sure you do. But I'm also assuming that obviously kind of leaving at 18 and moving to London may have encountered some homesickness. Or some creature comforts that you were missing?
Yeah, it was tricky. My parents separated when I was 17, so it was also a bit of an escape from all of that. And so that was, it wasn't, you know, a happy time in anybody's lives right then. So I think I just kind of felt like I needed to get off and do my own thing. Mm-hmm. So, and I always thought I would go back to Scotland. But then, you know, I met my then future husband, and I think, you know, you just kind of get into working, and then one job, then another job, and then, you know, we had a baby, and, you know, life kind of goes on. You know, just Steve's business was in London, then I started my business, and, you know, and then that was in London, and so it becomes like a bit of a tie, until then. The Australia kind of thing happened. It's all kind of still related to, I mean, food retail was really what we were in primarily, although we did work for kind of other high street retailers. But we did a lot of food retail. So design is where I was, not in food per se.
And so I'm thinking about when you're kind of setting up a home and you're having a family, are you bringing any family recipes with you? Are you bringing any of that, like, I'm going to make mum's mince and dough balls or things like that? Or are you starting from scratch in the big city of London?
I definitely did some stuff that mum used to make back in those days. But I was also then, you know, trying to impress my boyfriend with my culinary kind of, you know, abilities, and so I kind of started exploring a bit more. You know, we'd go down like Columbia Road, and, you know, at the time, you know, the coffee wasn't really much of a coffee culture, but even down there, it was like bagels with smoked salmon and cream cheese. That was kind of quite exciting. I'd never had anything like that before. I never come across a bagel in Scotland at that point. a milky coffee, I thought, this is great. And they had like a bagel and everything. I mean, that was all quite new. I mean, I sound like I'm 100 years old now, don't I? But all those things actually, you know, When you think of what's happened, I didn't have a mobile phone, you know.
Yeah.
I think things were different, you know. We used to actually barbecue quite a lot at home, you know, probably old school kind of charcoal and everything. But Mum always did these kebabs, and she'd tell everyone they were lamb, but they were lamb heart. And
Oh, yum.
I really want to, that's something that's on my list to kind of revisit. Look, it's not a Scottish dish, but you know, it's kind of, you know, it was kind of means to an end. And everyone who ate them was like, oh, that's delicious. What was that? Oh, lamb. Yeah, lamb. But, you know, but people are still, I think it's probably about 50-50. I know it's more fashionable now, but it's still about 50-50 about
People
people.
turn their nose up, or they're worried about offal and they don't want to, yeah,
People
engage
still
with.
freak out when you have haggis, you know. I mean,
Yes.
come
Yeah.
on, people. Get rid of them.
We're having a lot of conversations just now about what exactly Scottish food is. And it is interesting you say about lamb heart skewers aren't very Scottish, but then
It was
what
probably
is?
Scottish
What
lamb.
is? Well, I
And
know this is it, and this is what, you know, I get this a lot actually on social media. So that's not Scottish. There's nothing Scottish about that. And I'm like, well, you know what there is. And you know, it's like when you look back and people just assume there's this kind of really, and I think it's still lingering. I mean, and even still, when there's such good restaurants in Scotland now, there's such lovely artisan produce, there's such great cheese makers, and you know, smokers. Smoked fish in particular is best in Scotland I've ever had anywhere in my life ever. But yet, there's still a misconception that Scots don't eat vegetables and herbs. Forget it. But I mean, there's evidence that, you know, back at the, you know, back with the Picts were using, you know, herbs like wild thyme and wild garlic and everything
Yep.
to add, you know, flavor and nourishment to their meals. And it's like, you know, it's so incredibly frustrating. You know, if I've just been doing some research on spices and stuff, and I didn't even realize that juniper is native to Scotland, you know,
Yeah.
and you know, that many, apart from anything, gin, but you know, it's been used for centuries for flavoring and that sort of thing. And I think there's just so much of that gets lost in translation. And I think, you know,
I'm sort of lost in the stubborn belief that Scottish food is all very boring and plain or unhealthy. And
yeah.
it's like you, as you say, you look historically at the recipes. Yes, sometimes they're recipes from like the very wealthy,
Yeah.
but you know, as early as the sort of 17th, 18th century, the recipes are not just incredibly varied, but they've got a marked international influence, you know.
Oh, for sure. The French Scottish Alliance.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So much
I mean,
came
we
from that.
the Romans brought coriander seeds.
Yeah.
So we've
Well,
had
that's why
coriander
coriander
seeds.
is really prevalent in Scottish cooking. It seems bizarre, doesn't it? Because you'd associate it with more like Asian or
Yeah.
Middle Eastern.
Yeah. Well, if we've had potatoes for 300 years and the Romans brought coriander seeds, does that
Yeah.
mean that coriander is more Scottish than potatoes? And again, there's no real answer to this. It's all about like personal viewpoint, your own family recipes, what informs your notion of Scottish and what Scottish people are doing just now with food.
Exactly,
But
it's all formed by memories and what you know. And, you know, and like not everybody in Scotland would have been eating lamb heart kebabs, but like I say, my mum was quite adventurous in the kitchen. She was a good cook and she was creative like that. So, you know, but that's my memories, you know, as well, and that's what I grew up with. And but amongst that, there was also other things that were very Scottish. So, you know, it's I think it's just quite an. It's a really interesting thing because no matter like what you do, people seem to really love the really traditional, what they perceive as the traditional Scottish recipes. But even then, there's not one recipe that is the one, because
No.
every family had a version of how they might make it. Their mum would have done something differently, or sometimes it's like the dad would do something differently. It wasn't always the mums that were doing the So, I mean, and that's what makes it interesting, though. And I think it's nice when people do share that, oh, we used to do it like this and we used to do it like that. As opposed to saying, no, you're completely wrong. That's not Stovey's. I mean, that is it. Oh my God.
Don't get me started
Oh my God.
on
Stovey
that's not
days.
Stovey's.
Seriously.
Oh.
I mean, stories is like, you know, in its purest form, it's just potatoes and onions, right? But it's everyone had their own version, dependent on budget, dependent on what their grands, their mums made, dependent on what their families made, whatever those recipes were. Can we not just agree?
I have a question on stovies, and my question is, what do you normally have as a side, if anything, with your stovies?
No side.
Because a spoon.
All this beetroot nonsense. I don't know where that came from.
I'm Aberdonian, and beetroot and an oat cake. You needed beetroot and an oat cake with your stovies.
No, seriously, that's mental. I'm not No, we never had a side with stovies. If we did have one, it would have been something like cabbage, but I don't remember there ever being a side with it.
No, and I think that was part of the thing about stovies is it's like the eaten mess of Scotland, the savoury eaten mess, that it's just big, hearty, filling, simple food. I do think that like the discourse around stovies, I also speak a lot about morning rolls and things like this, the things which hit people somewhere in the heart. And I think it's good. It's a very healthy discourse because it's people caring and defending their food, which actually we don't have enough of in Scotland. So I do, despite my initial reaction, I do enjoy that. So I suppose the next thing is thinking, was it your early memories of barbecuing, which then made it easier to transition to an Australian way of life, or what brought you down under?
Well, I'd stopped working. I'd left my agency by then because, I don't know how much we want to go into that, but anyway, we had one kid and I was really struggling. I had multiple miscarriages and just decided that working full time wasn't going to give me the best option to continue our family, which was more of a priority to me than continuing the business. So we left that and we did then manage to have another kid. And during that time, my business went a bit sideways. Anyway, long story short, my business went into liquidation probably not long after I left. Was it something to do with me? Maybe, I don't know. It wasn't.
You can say that, it's fine. We're here for unbridled confidence.
It wasn't intentional that happened, but it did. And so some of the people we knew had gone to Australia, and that's ended up what brought us there. Steve, my husband, is also is a designer, has a design agency, and he was asked to set up a studio over there because there weren't a lot of retail specialists, and so that's what kind of took us over there. And they're working for a retailer in Australia, and so we just thought we'd go for a couple of years and see how that went, because like our youngest daughter was only two at the time, and so we just thought we'll go for a couple of years when the kids are wee and see how we go. But it'd be nearly 14 years later, and that again was completely unintentional, but it's just everything just kind of, you know, the rolling stone, as it were, kind of gathered momentum, and it just kind of had kept us there for a long time. And so it's a bizarre connection, and whoever knew that would even happen, but because we were so wedded to being in the UK.
And was there a point when you were in Australia or beforehand where you sort of felt a need to return to Scottish food, or where that kind of was it anything to do with being abroad, or like what kind of kicked off? Because obviously, you know, you ended up on Australian MasterChef, and it was
being on MasterChef, and then it was trying to find a point of difference, you know, and really all I had was being Scottish. And you know, at the time, Jobs and Frillo was one of the judges on, and he was Scottish too. So it was kind of quite a nice connection. So I was kind of doing, it wasn't particularly very directly Scottish food, but it was definitely some things in there that were influenced by it. So I started playing around with a lot more, looking back at the history and kind of trying to make more modern dishes, or fusing dishes with other things to kind of make it creative, because mince and potatoes, delicious as it is, probably wouldn't have gone, you know, got me very far.
It's maybe not as sexy as you needed to be.
But I did tried a lot of things, like, you know, making doing like Scottish Italian hybrid stuff, and I did fish pakora with a tatty scone taco and stuff like that. So I was kind of exploring it and kind of getting into it, and that's what kind of started me thinking about it. I think one of the things that I wanted to get from that MasterChef experience was I've always kind of really fancied doing a book, and I'd asked my mum years ago to write down all the recipes that, you know, she made for us when we were kids. But and she gave me a book at about five recipes in it. I'm like, where are all the recipes? You don't want all of that stuff. And I said, well, I do want all of that stuff. I want like potted hoe and like everything that you used to make. I do want all of that.
Yeah.
And she goes, well, I thought you'd think that was like rubbish. I said, no, that's exactly what I want. So then suddenly she managed to find my gran's cookery book.
Amazing.
Again, I didn't have that many recipes in it, but I did have a few. And then she pulled out this other thing, another book that she'd had, which is full of like different pieces of paper that were she'd never really properly compiled, but they're all like recipes written down from friends, all handwritten recipes, you know. Everyone used to share recipes like that. It's not like now where you just go on to Instagram and you search a hashtag and you get about like, you know, however many options of that particular dish. Everyone used to just write up the wee card and then pass it over. So, and I recognise the handwriting from, you know, family, friends and that sort of thing. So, yeah, and I started, I kind of have had refined it a wee bit more to being a lot more of the traditional stuff. Because people, that's what people seem to really respond to more than me being overly creative. So I try and get a wee bit of, you know, creativity into it. But it kind of all started from the MasterChef thing and me trying to take that experience kind of full circle to actually make this book that I'd asked my mum to do that she never really did, but it's expanded a little bit beyond what I ever thought that might be.
So we have a list of questions that we are asking all of our guests. They all have a strong Scottish flavour. But Lindsay, do you want to get us kicked off?
Absolutely. So our first question is, what is your morning roll order, both the type of roll and the filling?
Oh, I'm definitely a crispy roll.
Perfect.
Filling, probably. Oh, it's tricky. It's tricky. If it was Stornoway black pudding, I couldn't resist. Probably Stornoway black pudding, bacon, fried egg.
Oh, delicious.
A tripler. I expect nothing less. The next, our next question kind of is a lead on from that. We are putting together an annual commemoration to celebrate Florence Marion McNeil with a World Bannock Day. What would you put on top of your bannock?
Oh, I am a bit of a fan of scrambled egg and smoked salmon on my bannock. Oh,
yum. Sounds so
That's
good.
Absolutely delicious. Yeah, I'm so hungry. I haven't had my dinner yet.
No, me neither.
What to do? Smoked salmon butter with scrambled eggs. Just as a bit.
Oh, that is inspired.
Smoked salmon butter.
Yeah.
Well, like a okay.
So you kind of blend the smoked salmon into the butter with herbs and a bit of salt and maybe a bit of garlic, and then that goes on the bannock, and then you put the scrambled eggs on top.
Is this in a recipe?
Yeah, it's online.
Right, I'm going to.
one.
I'm going to go find this and cook that tomorrow morning for breakfast.
Sunday brunch, absolutely sorted. Okay, next question. We haven't moved on from baking yet, but in terms of bread, do you prefer plain or pan?
Pan.
Fair enough. Totally fair enough. Fair enough.
How do you have your porridge?
I'm a big fan of a savoury porridge, which I know is controversial, but that's probably my favourite.
And do you mean just salty, or are you adding like more things to the savoury porridge?
No, like an Asian savoury porridge, like garlic, ginger, and chicken stock, and then maybe crispy chicken skin, broccoli, jammy egg.
Yum, yum. Ottolenghi has a really good recipe for like a I think it's like a soy brown butter savoury porridge. So good.
It feels like we're getting closer to like an American grits with the way porridge is heading now, where it forms like the carb of a big savoury meal. And anyway, you go, Lindsay.
I think people are still a bit weird about it. People are, it's a bit split, the savoury porridge debate. I'm going to do a little segment on porridge when I get to it, because I get asked quite a lot how to make porridge, which I think is a bit odd, but I do.
That is exciting. I'm excited for that. Okay, tunnocks. Do you have a favourite tunnocks product between a log, a wafer, or a tea cake?
I didn't realise there was a bit of contention around the whole tunnocks thing, which I only found out about recently in terms of, you know, the patriotism aspect. But I'd probably go to tea cake if it was up to me.
Perfect. And if you were going to take a family recipe to add to a national cookery book, what would that family recipe be?
Oh gosh, that's a difficult one to come off the cuff. Well, I know everyone.
We'll accept lamb heart skewers is perfectly fine as well.
That's
if that's
a bit
your answer.
different, but I mean, it's like, I do think my mum's shortbread is the best I've ever had.
Yeah.
Lovely. Is
shortbread.
That with a corn flour, rice flour, plain flour?
Corn flour and icing sugar.
Lovely. Perfect.
Do you have an ingredient in your kitchen, just a sort of standard cupboard thing that you would say you reach for the most, or your favourite kind of kitchen ingredient?
Well, yeah, it's probably oatmeal. I go through, I can't tell you how much of that stuff. Everything. Oatmeal.
Do you have a sponsorship? Do you have a sponsorship in place?
No, I don't. It's ridiculous. I can't believe nobody's
done
to me.
You need, you definitely...
I literally put oats and everything. I can't believe nobody's even done that. Come on, people.
You need to be like Miss Scott Oats or something. You need to have a bobblehead.
I speak a bit to Hamlin's, but they can't send it to me in Australia. They'll send it to me when I come back here. If I come back here and do a bit of a foodie kind of content trip, which I might do later in the year, then they'll send me some and I'll do some work with them, because actually their Scottish oatmeal is the best anyway, I reckon. And it's very difficult to get that exactly like that overseas Scottish oatmeal.
Next question. Do you have a favourite Scottish word?
Oh, God, there's so many.
I'll say... Bahooki.
Bahooki. That
That's
is
great.
A good one. I don't say that enough.
No. Jeremy Lee's was ugh. Just ugh. A-C-H. So we've got ugh and Bahooki.
I feel like there's a theme going on here about the tone of general Scottish words. And then last question. Do you remember when you were wee, or whenever you really started cooking, like what was the job you were first given in the kitchen that was your responsibility?
I do remember I used to get, it wasn't really a job, but when she made tablet, she always tested it on a wee saucer beside the stove, and I always got that to eat.
Oh, delicious.
That's a very important job. Well, this is us at the end of today. So I have to say, for everyone, I mean, there's no one that's going to be listening to this podcast who has not already been thoroughly embedded into your algorithm. but please do check out Roving Haggis. I assume Roving Haggis was just because an expat abroad cooking Scottish food.
It was actually my nickname at work.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, we all had my two business partners gave everybody a nickname when they started. I had various, which I won't bore you with, but they landed on Haggis because it was the most polite of all the ones I got. And I think on one day, I because Tesco was my main client, I spent a lot of time out in Hertfordshire for their office. And I'd come into the office one day, and one of my partners had shouted, "Oh, here she comes, the roving haggis!" And it just had kind of like stuck. And I think then when I moved to Australia, I kind of thought I was to set up an Instagram account, and I thought, well, that was kind of appropriate because I had been kind of traveling, and so I didn't really even come up with it myself. It was one that was given to me.
I think that's even better, though. I think you can't, like, a nickname's never as good if you give it yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. But we won't. Maybe we'll edit this bit out so they don't feel like they get your due royalties when your best-selling book becomes a global bestseller and they come knocking for royalties on Roving Haggis.
Oh, it's all right. I've trademarked it now anyway. So
excellent.
Oh, good. Perfect. Wonderful.
Love that.
That's good. Well, listen, Ali, thank you so very much for spending some time with us. It has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you.
Lovely to speak to you guys too.
When I was listening to you talk about this writer and this time in Civil War Scott, there's an editor and a writer that I wanted to tell you about.
Okay.
So his name is William Sharp.
Right, that rings a bell.
And he was born in Paisley.
Okay.
It says he was born in 1855. So he studied at Glasgow University for 2 years and he was wanting to become a poet. And a writer and an editor. And he ended up getting ill before he could finish his degree.
I know.
He was from a bit of cash.
Right.
So as you did when you get ill, then you went to Australia.
Oh.
To recuperate.
Did you? I mean, I've heard of people taking to the sea, but taking to Australia
it's
is
not quite as grand as the French mountains for skiing. But He took to Australia to recuperate in the heat.
Wow.
The heat and the
dry
beach
heat.
And the dry
no,
heat.
No dampness, no nothing that will
no, exactly. Humans. And after that trip, he recovered and moved to London, and he kind of establishes himself as a writer, a poet, and an editor. Again, he's from Cash. He is connected. Mm. We listen and we don't judge. He marries his first cousin when he gets back.
Okay.
It's still okay.
I'm
Queen
sure
Victoria
they were very
has just
in love.
Done it. Yeah.
I'm sure they're just very in love.
Well, we don't know if they were in love because he then goes to Italy with her, ends up having either almost an affair or an affair that inspires him to write his first collection of poetry.
Wow, okay.
With his wife's best mate.
No, never the best friend.
Never the best friend.
Good Lord.
But the poetry's great, mm-hmm. not necessarily a success. He takes himself back to Scotland, and here he meets a writer called Fiona MacLeod.
Okay.
And decides he's going to help her to publish her work. Mm-hmm. She writes books about the Western Isles and Celtic mythology and like romanticism and like a kind of Mills and Boone kind of writer.
Yeah.
Writes some big pieces, and he edits all of her work.
That's a really lovely, sorry to interrupt you, but that's cool. A really lovely inversion of the normal like man getting a woman to edit and help. Like,
yeah.
The fact that he's doing this. Interesting.
And is her champion mm-hmm. for, and begins using his position as an editor mm-hmm. to push her writing out to people. And he's a really well-established writer. Like he does Eugene Lee Hamilton, who's one of the big poets of the era. Also, I believe posthumously edits Sir Walter Scott's books again for republishing. So, she goes on. So this woman, Fiona MacLeod, writes two formative books mm-hmm. that grip the nation and are bestsellers at the beginning of the 1900s. Mm-hmm. Her man, William Sharp, passes away all of a sudden, and Fiona will never put out another book again.
No way.
It's because she doesn't exist.
Are you kidding me?
Fiona MacLeod was the pen name of William Sharp.
And he was publishing as a woman.
Because he couldn't find either the market wasn't ready mm-hmm. for a man to talk about romanticism, mm-hmm. or he himself was tapping into the feminine arts and couldn't do it as himself. So we've had her food, we've looked at her book. What do you think Christian's legacy is in Scottish literature, in Scottish food? Where does she place?
I think she has an immense and underrated legacy that mainly comes... I mean, she had so many literary outputs that don't really get celebrated. As an editorist, as a journalist, she was an amazing woman. But I think what's really pertinent to me is the fact that this cookbook is always put forward as a key example of Scottish historical cookbooks, but she's often not mentioned in it. So I think her legacy is in the way she shaped it. It's one of our earliest printed, 18th century, 1755 onwards, you have these cookbooks printed in Scotland, but hers is one of the first that becomes really popular. And that's, I think, in part because of her expertise as a publisher. She knows how to market these things. She pulls upon Scott's characters. She does that whole literary play. But she also just makes a name for herself and for Scottish food in a really subtle, clever way. So this cookbook lives on as one of our best historical national cookbooks. And the way that she's undercutting literary traditions at the time shows how clever of a woman she was. And what I really love about her and this cookbook in particular is the way that it gets taken up and kind of there's lines between her and Florence Marion McNeil and the way that they were both in politics, they were both journalists, they're both also writing fiction. And in The Scots Kitchen, you find Meg Dodds's recipes or Christian Isabel Johnson's recipes. So I think what she really does is sets the scene for what then becomes what we now understand as historical Scottish food.
And I did go online I found two pieces of information about her, or two archive pieces about her. One was her death certificate, which talks about essentially that she had been ill for a long time. Mm-hmm. And in other articles I'd read online, it talked about, I think she'd had some late stage kind of cognition problems and had taken like a few years after she had left the Inverness Courier. But I found an obituary for her that had been reprinted that I think might be a nice way to end this episode.
Yes.
So it says, "We can add little or nothing to this affectionate and well-merited tribute from our Edinburgh contemporary. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson resided about 7 years in Inverness, dating from the commencement of this paper in December 1818. The deceased authoress enriched our columns with admirable literary articles and the discussion of social questions, in all of which she took a lively interest. The present century has seen few more noble or indefatigable workers than Mrs. Johnson." What a great Scot. This episode of the Scottish Food History Podcast was hosted by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist. Big thanks to Ali Stoner from Roving Haggis for joining us. This episode was produced by Tenement Kitchen.